Hello, welcome into In Focus on News Radio KMAN. Nick McNamara in for Brandon Peoples. Thank you, Dave. And we have a great show today. Oh, I see Dave turning on his microphone. I said thank you for the cue.
The cue. Yeah, all I did was point to you. That's what I do.
Well, I appreciate what you do, and I appreciate you leading me in.
You know what I appreciate?
What
is
Alana
that? Parker finding out that she's a Chiefs fan.
Oh.
She gave me a thumbs up this morning because I'm wearing some Chiefs red.
Oh, definitely.
Now, I wore my K-State sweatshirt in.
Okay.
So, I mean, it's over here, Stephen. Yeah, okay.
Good too.
Got that.
Yeah,
thank you.
You got it.
But the purple and red really don't work that well together unless it's like a Nike shoe.
I think if you accent it right, maybe it would work. You just have to find the right mix of the colors.
Yeah. Yeah. But red goes into purple, but with the two, you don't see any team combinations. No teams have purple and red as their colors.
No, I can't think of any.
No team.
Can't think of
none.
A single one.
Not exactly.
Maybe
exactly.
Maybe in Europe, maybe.
I don't know. Was it TCU? TCU's uniform, when I see them on the TV, I see purple and red. I don't know.
You know, you're right, because they did that because the Horned Frogs actually bleed out their eyes.
Oh, I didn't know.
And that's why they had some red in there. They had a little bit of red accents, which look goofy as all get it.
I think so, too.
Yeah.
What
yeah.
a fact. What a fact to bring up.
I know. Yeah, well, they're bleeding a lot of other things in Texas these days, so.
With that, Dave.
You're welcome. Glad I could be a part of the show.
Wonderful addition. I appreciate it, Dave. We're going to transition into some historical conversation from that. It's a great segue into talking about all of the Cold War history that's in Kansas as well as Manhattan locally. And, of course, we said your names already, but I'm going to introduce you a little more formally. We have Interim Director, Riley County Historical Museum, Alana Parker. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having us.
And it's been a while since I've been able to talk to you, so it's nice to see you again.
Yes. When you came out, I said, oh my gosh, it's Nick. So good to see you.
And of course, we also have retired K-State Assistant Dean, Stephen Graham. Thanks for being here, sir.
Hey, you're very welcome. Glad to be back.
Fantastic. And we're talking about the Cold War in Kansas today, and there was a lecture quite recently, and you also have a book here with you as well to talk about. So let's talk a little bit about how all of these programs, one at the Rotary, through the Historical Museum, and as well as K-State, how this all sort of culminated.
Sure. I'll lead off. Our good friend Stormy Kennedy, owner of Claflin Books here in Manhattan, called me up one day and said, hey, I just read this really interesting book, and I think you ought to read it. And so she said, stop by, and I'll give you a copy. It was called Cold War Kansas by Landry Brewer. So I read it, and it's not a real long book. It's, you know, just not a big one, but it was really fascinating. And so when I went back to Stormy, I said, yeah, that was really, really neat. She goes, well, don't you think we ought to have him come up here and speak to some groups? And I'm like, okay, sure. He's in southwest Oklahoma.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah, and so she said, well, I don't know how to do that, but you probably do. And I'm like, okay, fine. So I found him, and he's down on teaches at Southwestern Oklahoma State University and at Sayre, Oklahoma. I mean, literally southwest Oklahoma. So I said, hey, how would you like to come up and speak to the Manhattan Rotary Club and to the history department, political science people on campus? He's like, I've never done anything like that, but yeah, sounds fun. I've never been to Manhattan, so yeah. So we made it happen, and months and months later, he came here on October 28th, and we had a couple of programs, and it was really fun.
What would you say some of the reception was at the various programs you had?
I think a lot of it was kind of amazement, honestly. People that grew up here were like, man, I don't remember a lot of this, which we'll get into in a second. I grew up in Illinois, so I didn't know any of the things that we're going to talk about happening out here. I just had no idea. So it was just kind of amazement that, wow, all this stuff happened out here in Kansas, and it was super important to really the future of the world.
Yeah, and when you're living it, maybe it doesn't always have the same historical impact as when you're able to look back on it in hindsight, you know. And before we get into it, you mentioned Illinois. I'm from California, so we both have a little bit of a lack of that institutional knowledge of being here and living through some of these events. But with the book and with some of our historical studies, I think we'll be able to make it up, I think.
You bet.
So let's talk a little bit about how some of this begins. Okay. And how The Cold War really sort of became a sort of ever-present part of life, and how people began to start to react to it, and some of the programs that were instituted in response to it.
Right. After World War II, all of a sudden we had this tension between the United States and the Soviet Union. So starting in, you know, they now say 1947 is when they say the Cold War started, and it really went up clear till the dissolution of the Soviet Union in 1991. So over 40 years of this tension and struggle and scariness. So in 47, President Harry Truman announced that we would stop communism's attempt to undermine and control free people, and we would use economic, political, and if necessary, military assurance, which meant even use of the atomic bomb. And that's where then we come into the picture out here in Kansas. Then, you know, Dwight D. Eisenhower became president, and of course he really understood, you know, the what we needed to do, and also the scariness of this. And during his time, you know, we faced several nuclear scares as the Cold War moved along. So what happened was we decided in the U.S. to build intercontinental ballistic missiles, ICBMs. And they ended up having to be in specific places, which ended up being out here in the middle of the country, because you didn't want missiles from a submarine, a Russian submarine, to be able to hit them. So it ended up out here in the middle. But they also had to have the range to get from here to Russia. So there were a lot of, and then they wanted some, you know, lots of, you know, needed land to build these things. We had lots of land out here. So eventually what happened was we started building these bases of interconnected intercontinental ballistic missiles. And first we started at Forbes Air Force Base. And they didn't build them right there, but they would, you know, go to neighboring towns, Dover and different ones around, Wamego and et cetera. And so you had kind of a pod of these things. So they ended up with 9 Atlas-E intercontinental ballistic missile launch sites. And they started construction in 1959. Then Schilling Air Force Base in Salina, which we now know as K-State, you know, Polytechnic, and now the aeronautical, you know, campus. But that Air Force Base became hub for 12 Atlas-F ICBMs. And that started in 1960, the construction. And these were the first ones. Eventually, we had some newer ones down around Wichita. But these, and each one of these missiles had a warhead of 4 megatons that could deliver a nuclear bomb more than 200 times more powerful than what we dropped on Hiroshima or Nagasaki. And here we have 9, you know, out around Forbes and 12 around Schilling. That's kind of the start of this whole thing.
Isn't that amazing? I mean, my goodness,
that's
thinking
tremendous.
About that, when you see those numbers, it's frightening.
Yeah.
It is frightening.
Yeah.
How much was this knowledge sort of ubiquitous in the area? How well was the presence of these, maybe not the size and the scope of it all, but how well was it known that these are there and these types of weapons were there? Is it hard to say?
It's hard to say. I mean, I think probably people near these small towns, because they built them near this out here, you know, like out by Chapman and all these different smaller towns out in the countryside. I'm sure those people had some inkling that, well, something's going on. All of a sudden, there's a whole bunch of people, you know, Johnson Farm or whatever has been taken over, and the government is now bringing in all kinds of stuff, and people are getting hired to do something over there. We're not really sure what. You know, in talking to Stormy or a few others that grew up here in Manhattan, you know, they were just kind of vaguely aware of this in the area, but not, you know, like she said, I didn't understand all this either till I read this history book. I just didn't really understand what was going on right here around us.
And I think that's a really easy situation to be in. You know, part of the whole point of it was secrecy and to some degree. But even after the fact, we were talking about on before coming mm-hmm. on air about the Nike bases that were in California mm-hmm. that became hangouts for kids in like the mid-2000s, in my experience. There's a lot of young folks who would go out there. But, I mean, for a lot of people, that might be their only point of reference for these places as now abandoned locations.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, we had... Later than around the McConnell Air Force Base in Wichita, they put in a different type of missile, a newer one, and it was a different type of fuel mixture and everything. They're a little bit safer. So there are 18 eventually Titan II intercontinental ballistic missiles put in around the Wichita region. And these new ones, you know, were bigger, they could go farther, faster, and they carried a 9-megaton warhead. So that's over double the size of the Atlas ones. So it's over 400 times what, you know, the bombs that hit Nagasaki and Hiroshima. I mean, just unbelievable thinking of this, and thinking there's 18 of those things around Wichita, plus these others around here. But, you know, the other thing is and these are in surrounding states, too. Oklahoma has some, Texas, New Mexico, Colorado. In Nebraska, you have the Strategic Air Command, you know, and the bombers that could take off and fly. And then, you know, we also had Nike ground-air missiles around here. So, I mean, this region of the U.S. had a huge circle drawn around it on Russian maps.
Yeah, and I can see the logic behind, you know, the decentralized mm-hmm. placement of them as well, because one attack could disable your entire, like, missile array if you did not do so. So it makes sense to have them spread out that way. But from a, you know, from a living perspective, maybe a bit tense if you were aware they were all there, maybe a little bit tense. And, you know, it's probably about time for our first mm-hmm. break. We have a lot more to get into, but part of the show, we'd also like to talk to you. If you have any memories of some of the times as well as the locations we're going to be bringing up, feel free to call it in, 785-537-1350. We'd love to hear your thoughts. We'll be back on In Focus, News Radio KMAN.